Ursula K. Le Guin, born 1929, Berkeley, California. Knowing names, says the wizard Sparrowhawk in Ursula K. Le Guin's The Tombs of Atuan, is my job, my art, to weave the magic of a thing, you see, one must find its true name out. Le Guin grew up in a home where books and the names of things mattered. Her father, Alfred Kroeber, was one of America's pioneering anthropologists. Her mother, Theodora Kroeber, was an author whose best-known work, Ishi in Two Worlds, 1961, was based on her husband's studies of the life of the last surviving member of the Yahi Native American tribe. Word struck from childhood, Le Guin has published an amazing variety of writings, including poetry, fantasy, science fiction, realistic fiction, and essays. A Wizard of Earthsea, 1968, was her first work to be published especially for young readers, although, in characteristic fashion, that book and its sequels have defied categorization and gone on to find great numbers of devoted readers, both young and old. Written with intense clarity and lyricism and a salty wit, the Earthsea books abound in memorable observations, descriptions, and phrases, as this small sampling, chosen almost at random, will show. The question is always the same with a dragon. Will he talk with you or will he eat you? The Tombs of Atuan. That remarkable art, walking, to Hanu. To be oneself is a rare thing, and a great one, the farthest shore. Leonard S. Marcus, what kind of child were you? Ursula K. Le Guin, I was the fourth and only girl, and welcomed as such by parents and brothers, rather fragile as a baby, then became quite solid, obedient, bright, a good girl, too shy to play or talk with anyone at school until about fifth grade when I made a couple of friends. My parents and brothers were spirited, kindly, loving, highly intelligent people. My microcosm was a sweet one. Question. What are some of your first memories of stories and storytelling? Answer. Listening to my mother read The Swiss Family Robinson to my older brothers and trying hard to stay awake. Listening to my great-aunt Betsy talk about her life in Wyoming and Colorado and tell stories about the family while she ironed or cooked and I hung around. Listening to my father tell Northern Californian Indian stories at the campfire on summer nights in the Napa Valley. I think he was mentally translating some of them as he told them. The telling voice was very quiet and a little hesitant. Listening through the wall between our rooms to my brother Carl, telling himself heroic sagas of his own invention, with a lot of bangs and take thats in them. Acting out scenes from books with my brothers. I was one of the Belgae attacking Caesar's camp on a hill in California. About 10 years before I ever read Caesar, we got into a little trouble because of the catapult we built, which hurled large rocks quite efficiently. Later on, Carl was Robin Hood, and I was Little John. Have at thee, varlet! We got into a little trouble because of the quarterstaff combats. As my father pointed out, a quarterstaff can be a deadly weapon, though not often when wielded by 9-year-olds. Question. Did your parents encourage you to write? How and when did you begin? Answer. My parents both read all the time. My father wrote all the time when he wasn't teaching, and the house was full of books. Reading and writing were constant natural activities and pleasures, pretty much like eating and breathing. I started making poems quite young, at 5, I suppose, when I learned to write and went on doing so. I started trying to write stories at 9 or 10. I filled tiny notebooks with beginnings and sketches of stories. I submitted my first story to a magazine when I was 11 or 12. My parents neither specifically encouraged nor discouraged me in any way from writing poetry and stories. When I showed my writings to my parents, they made no fuss over them, did not highly praise them, but approved them fully, so that I always felt not that I was somebody special, but that what I was trying to do was absolutely worth doing. As I try to understand why their influence was so benign, it seems to me that they, my father particularly, were very much work-oriented, but not particularly achievement-oriented. That takes the curse off the work. Success is not the point. I think my father felt that to be able to do work you want to do was one of the greatest privileges and rewards life can offer. It is actually a rather rare privilege in our society. He enjoyed his work with gusto, not only his long intellectual career and his field work, but also gardening and tree planting and whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with all thy strength and all thy heart. Have I got that right? Question. Was there a librarian or teacher or other adult outside your family who was important to you as a young reader and writer? Answer. I had good teachers in the Berkeley schools, but was too shy and introverted to let them befriend me. Josephine Miles, a poet who taught at UC Berkeley, was most gentle and encouraging to me when my mother encouraged me to show her some of my poems at about age 14. She was a great, beloved teacher of poetry. She took me seriously, and so helped me take my writing seriously. Question. Was there a moment when you realized you were no longer a child? Answer. At 16, 17, 18 years old, I worked hard at figuring out my personal responsibility for what I did with my highly privileged life, and realized that this moral responsibility was also political. The fall of Czechoslovakia to the Russians was an awakening moment for me, and I guess I felt that to undertake such responsibilities was to be grown up, a burden, an honor. Question. Do you remember when you first read J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings and what you thought of it? Answer. In the mid-50s. I had been resisting the books, with their red and black staring eye covers and the fulsome reviews in the Saturday Review. I was suspicious. But one day at the Emory University Library, having nothing to read, I picked up the first volume and took it home. Next day I hurried to the library in terrible fear that somebody might have checked out the other two volumes. I got them, and my memory is that I read them in 3 days, which really is not possible, even for careless, galloping readers like me, is it? Anyhow, thereafter, Middle-earth has been one of the great kingdoms of this world to me, and I have gone back and back to it, as often as to War and Peace, I suppose. I am grateful that I was in my 20s when I first read Tolkien, and had gone far enough towards finding my own voice and way as a writer that I could learn from him endlessly without being overwhelmed, over-influenced by him. Question. The sea is such a powerful image in the Earthsea books. What do you think about when you look out at the ocean? Answer. Well, one thing I think, or rather feel, because it's not thinking, is that to look out westward to the ocean is natural, expectable, because I grew up looking straight out through the Golden Gate. From this I derived a deep conviction that the sea is supposed to be A, nearby, and B, to the west. When it's not, like in Ohio or on the East Coast, I feel that something is wrong and ought to be attended to. One of the immediate affinities I felt for The Lord of the Rings was that the ocean was in the right place. We now have a cottage in a seaside village in Oregon. I can see a bit of the breakers from the upstairs window. I walk a half block to the dunes from which one looks north to the headlands, miles south down the great beach and straight west to the sunset. Out of the golden, remote, wild west, where the sea without shore is, full of the sunset, and sad, if at all, with the fullness of joy. I remember my father reading those Swinburne lines aloud, and how my heart leaped at the sound and the vision and craved more. Question. Do you think of some animals, cats, for instance, as teachers or guides? Answer. Absolutely. Guides to life, to death. The trouble with most of what you learn from animals is that it has, like the animals, no words, which is frustrating for wordy people such as writers. But then that is exactly one of the things you learn from animals, that there is wordless knowledge. Question. The wizards of Earthsea know the true names of things, and that's what writers try to do, too. Are there ways in which writers of fantasy can get at the true names more readily than can writers of realistic stories? Answer. Well, it's far more direct for the fantasist. A Chekhov has to go through all that thick description of the real world, which the clarity of the true name scarcely can pierce through in gleams and glimpses only, but all the more precious for that, and cannot be directly spoken. The fantasist can fly straight to the light, but had better, like a moth, watch out, circle round and fly back into darkness. Too direct, it's all lost, a puff of smoke. As a sort of do-it-yourself Taoist, I have to add that the name that can be spoken isn't the true name. Question. Would you say why you think of the writer as a kind of discoverer and explorer? Answer. The word invent, or even making up, has always seemed a little too intentional and deliberate for what I do, which feels more like finding things, coming upon them. Places, people, patterns. But then invention really does mean finding, coming to something, doesn't it? Exploration is a very good word for what one does when thinking about a story before writing and while writing it. You are exploring a territory, finding out what happens there. Only you do it with thoughts, images, words, instead of with your body. Question. What is a typical workday like for you? Answer. Sit at desk with computer, in rainy season. In fine weather, sit on deck with notebook. 3 square meals. Question. Did you know, as you wrote A Wizard of Earthsea, that other related books would follow? Answer. Not a clue. Only after a year or so did I look at the book and realize I had left all kinds of leads and hints for what might follow. That was a happy day. What next? Where is my wizard going now? What have they all been up to? What does this mean? Why is that as it is? It has been that way through all 6 books. Question. What role does revision play in your work? Answer. Sometimes immense. Other times, when the piece has written itself, as they sometimes do, revision is fine-tuning. Tinkering, fiddling, getting things right, linking things and picking up echoes and variations on the theme throughout the story, getting the commas where they are needed and not where they're not. When major revision, rewriting is needed, it is hard work, but never as hard as first draft composition, not half. I love revising, actually. Composing, although intensely exciting and rewarding, is hard and scary and exhausts both mind and body. Revising is just gravy. I have to make myself stop. Question. What do you tell young people who say they want to write? Answer. Read. Write. Read. Write. Go on reading. Go on writing. Question. What is the best part of being a writer? Answer. Writing. An Ursula K. Le Guin reader. The Earthsea books. A Wizard of Earthsea, illustrated by Ruth Robbins, Parnassus, 1968. The Tombs of Atuan, illustrated by Gail Garrity, Athenaeum, 1971. The Farthest Shore, illustrated by Gail Garrity, Athenaeum, 1972. Tehanu, The Last Book of Earthsea, Jean Carl, Athenaeum, 1990. Tales from Earthsea, Harcourt, 2001. The Other Wind, Harcourt, 2001. Gifts, Harcourt, 2004. Captions to photographs. 1. Ursula Kroeber, age 3 or 4, in her brother's baseball uniform. 2. Page from The Days Before, a story written by Ursula Kroeber in 1942 at age 12. End of captions.